John Lear was a very famous guy because of his father. Everybody in Las Vegas knew him, and he was also at the time, he'd gotten involved in UFOs in 1987. He'd heard the Rendlesham Forest story from an Air Force buddy of his, and he suddenly got deeply involved in UFOs and started to put out the Lear briefing and the stuff about the Dulce underground bases. And he was putting out some stuff that was real and some stuff that was just crazy. He was getting the stuff from Cooper, all this stuff. He was putting it out. So he was a big name in ufology in the 1989. In fact, he was in charge of the MUFON conference, which was held in Las Vegas in 1989, the same one that Bill Moore made the famous speech about the fact that he was working for the government. So Lazar was a very prominent guy, or John Lear was a very prominent guy, but he also had sort of this sort of like a Richard Doty, Dan Smith, the sort of thing that people really didn't know what to believe of what he was saying. And
you mentioned Richard Doty. He has some pretty wild tales sometimes. One time he was telling me, you know, if he ever actually was in security at Area 51, he claims he was.
Yeah, I've heard that story. That's the whole point. You can't really track these things down because there really is no records.
Let me tell you something about Richard Doty. Rick Doty, one time he wrote me an email, and he said, I got to tell you something here, but you can't use my name, but it just happened. I just found out about it. And then he went into this wild tale about a Bigfoot-like character, a creature, that escaped out of Area 51 near the gate. And, you know, those wild stories like that, and you hear, you know, Doty was involved in Serpo a lot.
Yeah. But if you listen to, for example, one of the straight shooters that I listen to, if he says something, he's a straight shooter. That's Kit Green, who was the CIA analyst.
I completely agree with you.
And so if you listen to, for example, I mentioned this meeting at the CIA, the counterintelligence office, the day after this famous UFO cover-up live. Now, Richard Doty was on UFO cover-up live. He was playing the Falcon. They had him backlit, and he was pretending to be the Falcon. And what he was a cover for the real Falcon. He was a go-between between Moore and the Falcon. Moore wanted everybody to think that Richard Doty was the Falcon, which would protect the real Falcon. So he goes on UFO cover-up live. He's there, and he's doing this whole deal. The very next morning, at the CIA headquarters, they're having this meeting about it, and they all knew it was Doty. And they're making these things about, oh, he's got a problem. He's Richard, like Weaver and Hennessy were saying, oh, this guy got busted from the Air Force, because he was out of the Air Force by then. He got busted by the Air Force. This guy's bad news. And then Kit Green brings up the fact, no, he passed lie detector tests. One of his big defenders is Kit Green. And the story that's told is that Kit Green had an... If you read Gary Beckham's stuff, you can read this story. Kit Green has an encounter where he is approached by Richard Helms, who is the former CIA director. And Richard Helms is doing the core story. He's doing the big release. He calls Kit Green to this undisclosed location, and he basically tells him the whole story. The core story is true, the live alien, it's all sort of true. And Kit Green's head is just spinning, like, this is Richard Helms telling this story. And Richard Helms had told Kit Green, always believe what Richard Doty tells you about UFOs. And he broke off the communication, according to Kit Green, because there was all this bad mouthing about Richard Doty, and Helms said he broke off, he wouldn't have anything to do with them because they were bad mouthing Richard Doty. So there's these stories behind the scenes that sort of indicate that Doty is part of this overall government plan. And that's what I say is, he can tell you the story about a creature at Area 51. He can tell the story about Holloman happening in 64 when it happened in 71. And they're putting the stuff through him. In fact, there's some email, if you go to Gary Beckham's site, there's some email in 2006 that leaked correspondence between Pandolfi and Kit Green, and it all has to do with the Serpo thing. And Ronald Pandolfi is going after Richard Doty for being behind this, because Richard Doty says there's two DIA agents involved, and Richard Doty is possibly gathering this material to leak it to the Russians and all this sort of stuff. So they all knew, and they're all discussing that Richard Doty was part of Serpo, which he was, and it comes down to the same thing. The material's coming out, but because Richard Doty's telling the story, you can't tell whether that story at Area 51 is true, whether it's not true. Only people like Kit Green or people who have security clearances, and that's what Kit Green had said about Serpo. He said, I don't close the door. I couldn't believe when he said this. He was interviewed by these guys that did the Mirage Men, the book where they came to the States and they interviewed him. And at that point in this interview, and it's in the book, The Mirage Men, they're interviewing Kit Green, and Kit Green says, I wouldn't throw it totally out because I know there's classified material in there. And that's the same thing. Kit Green realizes that part of the Serpo story is true. Now, he won't detail which parts are true, which parts aren't, but that's how they do it. It's such a stupid story. And yet the story gets out, and people repeat the story, and everybody knows this sort of the basic Serpo story, and you're telling part that's true, part that's not true, and that's what they're doing. And I don't think there's any doubt of what they're doing. There's just so many examples of the same thing happening over and over and over again. And Kit Green, in the book, we actually quote Kit Green, and Kit Green says, and he tells it to these guys that are doing the Mirage Men book, and he says, if you have this situation, and I won't quote him, but it's a long quote in my book. If you have this situation and you're the government, what are you going to do? You have to some way to acclimatize people. So you tell all these crazy stories about aliens eating your kids and all this sort of stuff. And you run this for 20 years. And then when you release the final story is ETs are here. End of story, nothing's happening, and everybody goes, that's it? Just ETs are here? And it just drops it right down, and everybody goes, oh, I can believe that. I couldn't believe that the aliens eating people, but you hype the story up, and then when the story comes out, it's way tamer than the original story, and it doesn't scare people. And Kit Green, we quote Kit Green telling this story, and this hypothetical story about how this might be done.
In defense of Rick Doty, I have several pictures of him in what looks like Area 51. So I guess he was there at one time or another.
Yeah, and if you take a look at Moore's version, I mean, the way Moore described it, and Bill Moore, I have a different view of him than most people. Most people really didn't know him. I knew him and sort of trusted him for one reason, and that was when we did the Eric Walker story, we went to everybody. We said, we've got this high-level guy. This guy was involved from the word go. He was friends of Vannevar Bush. He was executive secretary of the Research and Development Board. He was chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, the biggest military think tank. This guy's talking. We could not get anybody. Nobody would deal with it. Stanton Friedman phoned him a couple times, and he wouldn't talk to Stanton. He said he'd read the Roswell book, made a couple of cracks about the Roswell book, but wouldn't talk to Stanton. And so Stanton sort of gave up on him and really didn't want to. Bill Moore was the only guy who offered to help us. And so to me, it was Bill Moore wasn't the disinformation guy who was trying to throw everybody off. He was a guy who actually helped Scott Crane and I. And he sent Kit Green, and he called him BJ, Blue Jay, who was the Kit Green. He sent Kit Green to Dr. Eric Walker's office. And we tell the story in the book that Kit Green went. It took like a number of months, and the messages were coming back from Bill Moore. And we were doing snail mail at the time. And he said, there's been a delay. My source is still going there. We're going to get to the bottom of this. I don't know whether to believe your story or not, but I've got a guy who, is at the level where Moore was indicating that Kit Green was the guy that would brief the president on UFOs. And this guy was going in there. And we tell the story that Kit Green goes in, and Kit Green worked for the CIA, and Walker was an expert. He had one of the co-developers of the homing torpedo during World War II. He ran the underwater submarine lab at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, or at Penn State. He was one of the three big Navy labs. He ran it. And so he had been involved in the Glomar Explorer, the Howard Hughes recovering of the Russian submarine in the Pacific. Walker had been involved in this, and so had Kit Green. So the story that came out was Kit Green and Walker talked about this, the old CIA days, about Glomar Explorer and all this sort of stuff, and everything went fine. And then Kit Green brought up UFOs, and as soon as he did, It was this, you know, the same sort of thing when Bob Emminger went to see General Weinbrenner, where Weinbrenner starts, you know, writing, drawing MIGs on the board and talking about weather modification and stuff. And Emminger's going like, well, maybe he didn't hear my question. He's asking about the Holloman Air Force Base film. And he's sort of acting like he's crazy. Walker did exactly the same thing. Kit Green, the story that I saw him tell was that Walker just sort of freaked out and he started to talk to a pile of books in the corner of the office. And he said, the president didn't say I got to talk to you. I'm not telling you anything. And he basically threw Kit Green out of the office. So I sort of trusted Moore, that Moore was actually trying to do trying to get inside the government. The mistake he made was that he passed the one document to Benowitz that he knew that had been altered and openly discussed this in this speech in 1989. And then people started throwing stuff at him and people were yelling while he was trying to speak and stuff like that. And his career was over the minute he mentioned this document, even though he mentions the fact that Jalen Hynek was involved as well, that he was working for the government, that he had actually given Benowitz a computer. And that he told Benowitz the computer was to help him monitor these UFOs. And the computer was actually to do nothing about that. It was to monitor what Benowitz was doing. So he actually said that there was lots of researchers that Moore said were on the inside. So Moore describes Doty, and he basically said that Doty was just working for the government the same as us, that Doty was being told by the Falcon what to do, and that was part of his job, was to look like an idiot, to call Linda Howe in there and tell Linda Howe I got this briefing for the President of the United States, and to put the Aztec story in her document. And that was part of his job, was to actually tell Linda Howe, I'm the Falcon, because they wanted... He was just following orders the same as everybody else. And I believe Moore's story that Doty was a low-level guy. I wrote him one letter. He replied to me. He wasn't the smartest guy. And Bob Pratt, who co-authored this book with Moore that Doty had a lot of influence in, called Project Aquarius in 1981, said that is his opinion as well, is that there's no way that Doty was behind this whole thing. Doty was not smart enough. Doty was a low-level guy who was just doing what people told him to do. He was just good at lying. He was good at telling stories. And so they gave him the true stuff, the false stuff. And he was working for the sort of the disinformation people at Kirkland Air Force Base. That was his job. It was to, AFOSI is to gather intelligence and to run counterintelligence against people who get into Air Force programs to throw people off. That was his job. So he was only an intermediary to the real Falcon, and Moore had lots of different sources. And the other thing that shows that Doty really wasn't part of this, and neither was Moore a part of this, because Doty left the Air Force, I believe, in 1987. Bill Moore, after he made this speech in Las Vegas in 1989, I mean, he couldn't have given a lecture the rest of his life. He was just totally ostracized by the UFO community. Nobody would have anything to do with him once he mentioned the fact that he handed a phony document to another researcher. He leaves the field in 1989, and then people, when they argue there's no MJ-12 and this is all these, the Moore hoax, the document with Richard Doty, completely leave out the rest of the story, is that in 1990, the flood of MJ-12 documents starts to flow. And we talk about this in the book. They're called the new MJ-12 documents. And they were brought out by this Cooper guy, and they were handed over to Bill, Bob Wood and his son Ryan Wood. And when I asked Ryan one point, they had a book. I was with him at the Crash Saucer conference. We're going through some of these documents. And I said to him, I said, well, how many pages of documents are there? And he said, 4,000 plus. So 4,000 pages of documents. And these are fairly sophisticated documents, because Bob Wood was giving some of this stuff in there. It was the same thing. Some of the stuff he knew was real in these documents. And he was taking these documents very seriously. So was Ryan Wood. So they're taking them seriously. So it's going to take some effort to put out these documents. 4,000 pages of documents. This is not Richard Doty. This is not Bill Moore. This is a government agency putting out this material for a specific reason. This is a lot of money. This is a lot of time by some agency to do something very specific. And to me, it's to get out the sort of the core story, the people that were involved, to tell the story in this fictionalized version that the CIA uses when their agents tell their stories.
Interesting little shop talk here. Joe Champion, our producer in Chicago, is monitoring some of our people that are listening to us. And there are 7 people that have come online from what looks like CIA headquarters in Virginia. So you got fans.
Yeah, I guess they're just seeing if
we can't prove that, but it looks like that's we've seen those the same identifying marks before. So you never know.
I know Pandolfi's still active. I mean, some people have indicated that he's sort of lost sort of power inside the CIA and that he's sort of on the way down and he's got all sorts of personal problems. But I think he's still active. I don't think – like he was moved up to the – for about a year to this National Intelligence Office. I mean, if he's in a bad state, you don't move him up to that office. I think, you know, as I look at it, I think all these guys are just doing their job, and part of the job is to protect classified information. That's why I don't think you'll ever see a document that's legitimate, because I tell the story that last year, you remember Obama, the Republicans went after Obama for leaking the story that they were using drones to assassinate people in Pakistan and all these different countries, and they're accusing Obama of sabotaging the Iranian nuclear program, their computers, and they were going after Obama. And so if they can go after the president of the United States for leaking classified material, any whistleblower like the Falcon, you're not going to get a legitimate document, because it doesn't matter who it is. If you release classified information, it's against the law and they're going to get you. Simple as that. So I think they're trying the best they can. I think there's a lot of rules, regulations. They have certain stuff to protect, and I think that's part of Pandolfi's job, is to watch what's going on in the UFO community, to see if some scientist who's interested in UFOs suddenly crosses over the line and releases classified material in the UFO community. There's a careful watch of what's going on, and one of the other things that Dan Smith says, that the reason the CIA watches is that they can't control the phenomena. They call it a phenomenology problem. It's and this is the word that's used. John Alexander uses it. You saw Chase Brandon use it. Dan Smith uses it. Pandolfi uses it. Phenomenology. That it's a whole range of phenomena. It's not just UFOs. It's remote viewing. It's consciousness. It's all these different sort of things. And according to Dan Smith, Pandolfi had said that there's this phenomenology problem, and that because they can't really control what the UFOs are doing, they watch what the researchers are doing. They follow the researchers to find out what's going on. And I think that's part of the thing. I don't think it's any sort of nefarious thing. They have a job that you don't want this kind of stuff getting into Al-Qaeda's hands, so you want to control it. There's a lot of very sophisticated technology involved here, stuff that would, if it got into enemy hands, would be devastating. I mean, just the idea of aliens, you know, being able to come into somebody's house, take somebody without the person even knowing what's going on, get into their head, give them instructions, make them passive. That kind of stuff has to be protected. If you're somebody working for the military establishment, you don't want the Russians getting it. You don't want the Chinese getting it. You're pretty sure that the Russians and the Chinese are working on it. So they're very interested in this whole thing. And yet there's this whole sort of, I think, this split where they're trying to sort of get the story out so that you don't have the people back in 1947 where they have absolutely no idea, and suddenly you get something you can't control and the cover-up breaks, and suddenly you have to sort of unleash 65 years of lies. So you just sort of, as Kit Green describes, you build up this sort of this wild scenario about what's going on, and then when the story leaks, you hope that it's going to be less than the stories that you've made up, so that people will sort of be toned down and say, oh, okay, that we can deal with that. That's nothing compared to what I heard was going on.
Well, we picked up one more listener from IP there in Virginia. Hey, guys, don't just listen. Call in. Ask some questions. Give us some information. 888-919-2355. Let's talk a little bit about Area 51. Do you think there's an ET there now?
Well, they would have moved it. I mean, they had to move it because of the fallout. that they didn't realize that this thing was going to sort of spiral out of control, that Knapp was going to start doing specials. And Knapp talked about, you know, every time he had John Lear on, it was like the phone would just go nuts. I mean, they'd have him on at 6 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, and just like everybody would be watching. It was just like a story that if you Google search Area 51 and compare it to the Great Wall of China or the pyramids, there are more hits on the Area 51. This is one of the most famous places in the world now. So it sort of got out of control. But the important thing that I put in the book that people should know is that it was all planned, that this was not some sort of thing where he went on there and he decided that he was going to squeal. As I mentioned, there was three interviews. He went to EG&G before he went up to the site. He phoned Dr. Teller, who he had met at Los Alamos years earlier, said he wanted to get this job. And it was John Lear who was telling him to go up to the test site, get a job up at the test site. And so he was offered by Teller to either go to Livermore Labs in California or to Area 51. He said, well, I'd like to go up to the test site. So he said, okay, fine. He gets these interviews at EG&G. There's three interviews. And John Lear tells his story. And Knapp agrees. We were just talking to Knapp the other night. Knapp agrees with this version of the story that in the second interview, all the questions were technical, all three interviews, except for the first question in the second interview, which tells you the entire Area 51 story. The first question in the second interview was, do you know John Lear? And what do you think about him? And Bob Lazar said, he sticks his nose in where it doesn't. I know him, and he sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong. And this is the key, that John Lear was this very prominent UFO guy. He had this background. His father, very famous. He was known. He'd run for senator in Nevada. Everybody knew who he was. And so they knew that Lazar knew John Lear. And so he has a background. His background is in rockets. He would drive around in Las Vegas in a car, a Honda, with a rocket engine in it. His expertise was rockets. There's like 5,000 people at Area 51. They're all working on jet engines. So do they put them up with the jet engine people? No, they put them up at S4, which supposedly only had about 24 people working at it, made this story up that some guy got killed. We've got to stick you in here. And a lot of people don't realize that he was only there a couple of days. If you add up all the hours that he did, he was only there a couple of days. And Gene Huff, who is a very close friend with Lazar, confirms the fact that when he got to the site, part of his job was to tell the Area 51 people, the UFO people, what John Lear was doing. So they knew that he knew John Lear. Now, if they knew that he knew John Lear, why are you going to stick him up on the test site with the Area 51, with the saucers, when you know that he's going to go and tell John Lear, and John Lear is going to tell everybody? So the first thing they do when he gets up to the test site, and I've trained people, I know this, the first day the person comes onto a job, you don't give them 125 documents that detail all the intricacies of how the aliens got here and underground battles and how the UFO flies. You don't do that. You show the guy where the washroom is. You show him where the lunchroom is. The first day, nothing happens the first day. And yet, as soon as he gets there, they give him 125 documents to look at, knowing that he's going to go and tell John Lear what he saw. And of course, the stuff they give him, whatever he learned there, you can't believe any of it, whether what was true or was false, is because they're going to give him a bunch of stuff that's garbage, and he's going to go back, and sure enough, John Lear tells the story. December 6th, he goes up, and he comes back to John Lear's place, and he says, John, I was up at the test site today. I saw a saucer. And John says, what, you're at the test site, you saw a saucer? Was it theirs or was it ours? And he said, it was theirs. He said, oh, what are you doing here? You know they're going to be watching you. I mean, why don't you work up there for a couple of months and then come tell me what's going on? What are you doing here now? And he said, no, John, I wanted to tell you. You spent all these years, people laughing at you, and I wanted you to know. So he squealed the first day. He started to leak this stuff to John Lear. And one of the things that's absolutely confirmed is that they went on what they called fishing trips. And this was in March and beginning of April 1989, just before the story broke. They go up to Lazar comes to John Lear and he says, they're going to test a saucer tonight. And they're outside. They're outside John Lear's house. They're going to test a saucer tonight. And John says, they are? He says, you want to come? He said, well, yeah. So they go up to the test site and they come in from the backside, so they're not actually on the base. And he says they're going to test the saucer Wednesday night, 9 o'clock. And John Lear describes his story. He's described it numerous times. They're in the motorhome. John was there. Lazar was there. Huff was there. Lazar's wife was there. And a bunch of other people were there. And John said, 9 o'clock, there it was. came up over the mountains exactly at the same time. And the whole point was, and this happened 3 weeks in a row, the point was that if he'd only been there for a couple of hours over these couple of months, how did he know when the tests were going to be taking place? I mean, he's just a rookie guy who really shouldn't be given access to anything highly classified. They told him where the test was because they knew that he would take John Lear out to see the test. And so the third night of the test is they get caught. They get caught by security. And they get stopped by the police when they actually, after security lets them go, the police stop them on the highway, and they're held there for an hour, and then the police let them go. The next day, Lazar tells a story about being taken to Indian Springs, being given this thing, put the gun to his head. You know, when we told you it was top secret, we didn't mean you're going to bring your friends out to watch the test. And they basically say to him, we're going to pull your security clearance for a while. Now, if this is the most highly classified subject in the world, and this guy is leaking it, you throw him in jail. You don't say we're going to pull your security clearance for a while. And they basically, the next day or a couple of days later, they invite him to come back at the Area 51 to work. So here's this guy has leaked this stuff. He's leaked it to John Lear, and they invite him back onto the site, which makes no sense whatsoever. You throw him in jail. So they wanted him to go back. They wanted him to feed more stuff. What they didn't realize was that at that point, Lazar was scared, and he said, no, I'm not going back, and he quit. And that's when they went to George Knapp at KLS-TV, and George Knapp said, okay, and they changed his identity. They called him Dennis, which was Lazar's security handler, the guy that went around with him when he was working. And they do the backlight. He tells the story about Area 51, and the story just explodes. And then it's over. They didn't realize he was going to go to the TV. They didn't realize that George Knapp was going to do this thing, and they absolutely didn't realize that this thing would go around the world and everybody would be watching it. It'd become the biggest story of 1989.
Yeah, I was in Las Vegas during that time. I remember all that well. You mentioned three ETs. One of them, I guess, is from the Kingman UFO crash. Has that been confirmed?
Well, the core story was put together supposedly by Hal Puthoff, Jacques Vallée, and Kit Green. They met at a restaurant, Perkins, I can't remember what the restaurant was, in 1987. And what they did is they sat down and they tried to decide, what do we know for sure? There's so much garbage, like so much disinformation inside the information that's coming out. What do we absolutely know for sure? And it became known as the core story. The core story is there was a crash, recovered bodies, and these live aliens. Now, it wasn't recovered from crafts. For example, Ronald Pendolfi, in 1991, the last one left about 1991, supposedly. It was being held at a safe house off the mall in Washington, D.C. And when Dan Smith gets involved, he's interested in crop circles. And he makes a contact in NASA. Somebody in NASA gives him Ronald Pendolfi's name. He phones Ronald Pendolfi at the CIA. Ronald Pendolfi talks to him. Then they have a second phone conversation in September of 1991. And at that point, Ronald Pendolfi says, I'm going to Los Alamos tomorrow to talk to the live aliens. And, of course, Dan Smith doesn't take that lightly. And this is just when the Internet was starting. Dan Smith puts this on, I can't remember what the name of the Internet thing was. It was just just words. There was no pictures or anything on the Internet. And this thing just sort of, everybody starts phoning the CIA and what's going on. And he phones Los Alamos. And he says, well, is Ronald Pendolfi coming there for a meeting? And they put him through to John Alexander. And John Alexander says, yeah, he's coming here. And he didn't mention the UFOs or anything. He hung up the phone. And then Ronald Pendolfi contacts Dan Smith back, and he says, next time you do this, make sure that you don't have my name and the CIA in the same sentence. So this is the third one. There were supposedly three. And they were sort of like the story, the core story supposedly is like they were ambassadors. And there was the early one. Then there was one left in 64, which was a female. These aliens wrote
now,
this.
Now, that was the ambassador, right?
Yeah, there's three, and they were supposedly ambassadors. And the stories told the last one, the one that sort of Ronald Pendolfi was joking about or referencing this 1991 one was the one that Jamie Chandray went after. That Jamie Chandray had even higher level contacts, because both Bill Moore and Jamie Chandray, we reveal in the book, were CIA assets. Bill Moore confirmed to the story was that Bill Steinman, the guy who discovered Walker, had also discovered that one of the guys from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base had been moved to Kirkland Air Force Base. His name was Dr. Eric Wang. And this guy was supposedly deeply involved in the crash saucer program, and that he had died of a heart attack in 61 or something like that. So Steinman phones Wang's wife, and this is Maria Wang, who was a high-level something or other in Albuquerque. And he's talking to her about what's going on, and she says, well, if you really want to know what's going on, you should actually talk to Henry Kissinger. He's the guy who would talk to my husband. He was the one that was running the flying saucer program at that time. So Steinman's all excited about this, and suddenly he gets a phone call from Bill Moore. And Bill Moore says, what are you doing talking to Maria Wang? And Steinman says, well, how do you know I was talking to her? And he said, I know you're talking to her. You said this, she said this, you said this. And Steinman says, how did you know that? Did you have the phone call? How did you know this? How did you get the phone call taped, or what's going on? And he was really upset. And so Moore says, okay, come to my place tomorrow, and I'll explain to you what's going on. So he goes to Bill Moore's house, and Bill Moore tells him, he says, when I was in university, I was recruited by the CIA. I did a couple of papers for them. I did a little bit of research for them, and then I left. I didn't do anything more. And when I got into UFOs, I went back and reestablished my contacts inside the CIA. When the MJ-12 document started, when this whole thing started, Bill Moore was in contact with this guy by the name of the Falcon. So in 1982, Bill Moore tells a story, which we document in the book, that the material was coming in so fast from Falcon, the amount of material as to how the operation worked and what the programs were and the agencies and stuff, he didn't know what to do. He couldn't handle it himself. So what does he do? He's friends with Stanton Friedman, who helped him break the Roswell story, write the Roswell book, do all the research. Does he take Stanton Friedman as his partner to go through all this material from the Falcon? He ignores Stanton Friedman, and he picks up Jamie Chandray. And Jamie Chandray was the guy who got the document, the MJ-12 document, in his mailbox in 1994. And one of the things the MJ-12 skeptics always bring up is, well, why was it mailed to Jamie Chandray? In 2004, Bill Moore did an interview, and he said, well, most people don't know, but Jamie Chandray was CIA. He'd done work for the CIA. And he tells a story about being in a meeting in the CIA, talking about him and stuff like that. So both Bill Moore and Jamie Chandray were CIA assets. They had contacts to the CIA. That's how they got all these high-level sources. So these kind of things that people don't realize when you talk in the MJ-12 document, that there's stuff behind it. And so at the end, Bill Moore leaves the field in 1989 after making this speech, and everybody's upset with him. And Jamie Chandray hangs on a little bit longer because he's trying to get to this third live alien. They're getting these, what are called, if you read Robert Collins' book, they're getting these messages, and the parrot is one of the birds, and they're getting these messages sort of in rhymes and riddles, and they're coming in postcards and stuff, and it's indicating that this third live alien is in Washington. So Jamie Chandray is trying to go to Washington, and he finally gets there in 1995, finds out the live alien is already gone. He gets to see this room or whatever was there, and at that point he quits, and he tells Bill Moore, he said, I am now absolutely convinced. I was shown something that absolutely convinces me that the UFO phenomena is real. I've seen enough. I'm leaving. And he quits the UFO field. Now, nobody knew, except Bill Moore was asked about this in an interview in about 2004 and said, well, what did he see? What did he tell you? And he said, well, he wouldn't even tell me what he saw. But what I think he saw was the crystal. They showed him this crystal that the aliens had, that you could actually look at events in the past, and that was his version. So you have them all trying to establish this story about these three ambassadors, these alien things. But again, it's like everything else. You can't really nail it down because all you're getting is stories from, say, intelligence sources or people, but there are no legitimate whistleblowers. Everybody who's a whistleblower is somebody who's working for the government who has been set up like Richard Doty or like Lazar, whether they're witting or not witting, that they're getting material. They may think they're leaking real material, but they're leaking stuff that's partly true, partly false. So there is no real documents. There are no real whistleblowers. All of it is this game of mirrors and quicksand for a floor, that nobody knows what's going on. and the story is sort of getting out, but you maintain the whole thing, because there are national security implications. I've heard this before, is that, you know, a lot of us in the UFO field were screwing things up, that there are very serious national security implications in this thing, and it's sort of like, let us, we're the smart guys, we have the experts, let us handle this problem. And it is a problem to them. They, like us, are trying to figure out what's going on. They don't have all the answers. They can't control what the UFOs are doing.
Grant Cameron, the clock has this, the time is up.
Beautiful.
The name of the book again?
Is UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants.
Thanks for being on. It's always a pleasure having you.
I appreciate it, and take care, Jerry.
Okay, thank you.
Our time's up. We'll be back next week. It's a pleasure being here again on Inception Radio after a month hiatus due to health issues. Hopefully we can continue every week, so keep joining us, 7 until 9 Eastern Time. Until next time, this is Jerry Pippin. Thanks for listening. Cheers.